The Audio Partners Publishing Corporation is pleased to present The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett, read by William Dufresne. This is complete and unabridged, an Audio Editions Mystery Master.
Spade and Archer. Samuel Spade's jaw was long and bony, his chin a jutting V under the more flexible V of his mouth. His nostrils curved back to make another smaller V. His yellow-gray eyes were horizontal. The V motif was picked up again by thickish brows rising outward from twin creases above a hooked nose, and his pale brown hair grew down from high, flat temples in a point on his forehead. He looked rather pleasantly like a blonde Satan. He said to Effie Perrin,
"Yes, sweetheart?"
She was a lanky, sunburned girl whose tan dress of thin woolen stuff clung to her with an effect of dampness. Her eyes were brown and playful in a shiny, boyish face. She finished shutting the door behind her, leaned against it, and said,
"There's a girl wants to see you. Her name's Wonderly."
A customer?
I guess so. You'll want to see her anyway. She's a knockout.
Sure in, darling, said Spade. Sure in.
Effie Perrin opened the door again, following it back into the outer office, standing with a hand on the knob while saying,
"Will you come in, Miss Wonderly?"
A voice said, "Thank you," so softly that only the purest articulation made the words intelligible. And a young woman came through the doorway. She advanced slowly, with tentative steps, looking at Spade with cobalt blue eyes that were both shy and probing. She was tall and pliantly slender, without angularity anywhere. Her body was erect and high-breasted, her legs long, her hands and feet narrow. She wore two shades of blue that had been selected because of her eyes. The hair, curling from under her blue hat, was darkly red, her full lips more brightly red. White teeth glistened in the crescent her timid smile made. Spade rose, bowing and indicating with a thick-fingered hand the oaken armchair beside his desk. He was quite 6 feet tall. The steep, rounded slope of his shoulders made his body seem almost conical, no broader than it was thick, and kept his freshly pressed gray coat from fitting very well. Miss Wonderly murmured,
"Thank you,"
softly as before, and sat down on the edge of the chair's wooden seat. Spade sank into his swivel chair, made a quarter turn to face her, smiled politely. He smiled without separating his lips. All the V's in his face grew longer. The tappity-tap-tap and the thin bell and muffled whir of Effie Perrin's typewriting came through the closed door. Somewhere in a neighboring office, a power-driven machine vibrated dully. On Spade's desk, a limp cigarette smoldered in a brass tray filled with the remains of limp cigarettes. Ragged gray flakes of cigarette ash dotted the yellow top of the desk and the green blotter and the papers that were there. A buff curtain window, 8 or 10 inches open, let in from the cord a current of air faintly scented with ammonia. The ashes on the desk twitched and crawled in the current. Miss Wonderly watched the gray flakes twitch and crawl. Her eyes were uneasy. She sat on the very edge of the chair. Her feet were flat on the floor as if she were about to rise. Her hands and dark gloves clasped a flat, dark handbag in her lap. Spade rocked back in his chair and asked,
"What can I do for you, Miss Wonderly?"
She caught her breath and looked at him. She swallowed and said hurriedly,
"Could you... I thought...
Then she tortured her lower lip with glistening teeth and said nothing. Only her dark eyes spoke now, pleading. Spade smiled and nodded as if he understood her, but pleasantly, as if nothing serious were involved. He said, "Suppose you tell me about it from the beginning, and then we'll know what needs doing. Better begin as far back as you can."
"That was in New York."
"Yes?"
"I don't know where she met him. I mean, I don't know where in New York. She's 5 years younger than I, only 17, and we didn't have the same friends. I don't suppose we've ever been as close as sisters should be. Mama and Papa are in Europe. It would kill them. I've got to get her back before they come home."
"Mm-hmm, yes," he said.
"They're coming home the first of the month."
Spade's eyes brightened. "Then we've 2 weeks," he said.
"I didn't know what she had done until her letter came. I was frantic."
Her lips trembled. Her hands mashed the dark handbag in her lap.
"I was too afraid she had done something like this to go to the police, and the fear that something had happened to her kept urging me to go. There wasn't anyone I could go to for advice. I didn't know what to do. What could I do?"
"Nothing, of course," Spade said. "But then her letter came."
"Yes, and I sent her a telegram asking her to come home. I sent it to General Delivery here. That was the only address she gave me. I waited a whole week, but no answer came, not another word from her. And Mama and Papa's return was drawing nearer and nearer, so I came to San Francisco to get her. I wrote her I was coming. I shouldn't have done that, should I?"
"Well, maybe not. It's not always easy to know what to do. You haven't found her?"
"No, I haven't. I wrote her that I would go to the St. Mark, and I begged her to come and let me talk to her, even if she didn't intend to go home with me. But she didn't come. I waited 3 days, and she didn't come. Didn't even send me a message of any sort."
Spade nodded his blonde Satan's head, frowned sympathetically, and tightened his lips together.
"It was horrible,"
Miss Wunderlich said, trying to smile.
"I couldn't sit there like that, waiting, not knowing what had happened to her, what might be happening to her."
She stopped trying to smile. She shuddered.
"Address I had was General Delivery. I wrote her another letter, and yesterday afternoon I went to the post office. I stayed there until after dark, but I didn't see her. I went there again this morning and still didn't see Corinne, but I saw Floyd Thursby."
Spade nodded again. His frown went away. In his place came a look of sharp attentiveness.
"He wouldn't tell me where Corinne was,"
she went on hopelessly.
"He wouldn't tell me anything, except that she was well and happy. But how can I believe that? That is what he would tell me anyhow, isn't it?"
"Sure," Spade agreed. "But it might be true."
"I hope it is. I do hope it is,"
she exclaimed.
"But I can't go back home like this, without having seen her, without even having talked to her on the phone. He wouldn't take me to her. He said she didn't want to see me. I can't believe that. He promised to tell her he had seen me, and to bring her to see me, if she would come this evening at the hotel. He said he knew she wouldn't. He promised to come himself if she wouldn't.
She broke off with a startled hand to her mouth as the door opened. The man who had opened the door came in a step, said,
Excuse me.
Hastily took his brown hat from his head and backed out. It's
all right, Miles, Spade told him. Come in. Miss Wunderlich, this is Mr. Archer, my partner.
Miles Archer came into the office again, shutting the door behind him, ducking his head and smiling at Miss Wunderlich, making a vaguely polite gesture with a hat in his hand. He was of medium height, solidly built, wide in the shoulders, thick in the neck, with a jovial, heavy-jawed red face and some gray in his close-trimmed hair. He was apparently as many years past 40 as Spade was past 30. Spade said,
"Miss Wunderlich's sister ran away from New York with a fellow named Floyd Thursby. They're here. Miss Wunderlich has seen Thursby and has a date with him tonight. Maybe he'll bring the sister with him. The chances are he won't. Miss Wunderlich wants us to find the sister and get her away from him and back home."
He looked at Miss Wunderlich. "Right?"
"Yes,"
she said indistinctly. The embarrassment that had gradually been driven away by Spade's ingratiating smiles and nods and assurances was pinkening her face again. She looked at the bag in her lap and picked nervously at it with a gloved finger. Spade winked at his partner. Miles Archer came forward to stand at a corner of the desk. While the girl looked at her bag, he looked at her. His little brown eyes ran their bold, appraising gaze from her lowered face to her feet and up to her face again. Then he looked at Spade and made a silent, whistling mouth of appreciation. Spade lifted two fingers from the arm of his chair in a brief warning gesture and said, "We shouldn't have any trouble with it. It's simply a matter of having a man at the hotel this evening to shadow him away when he leaves, and shadow him until he leads us to your sister. If she comes with him, and you persuade her to return with you, so much the better. Otherwise, if she doesn't want to leave him after we've found her, well, we'll find a way of managing that." Archer said, "Yeah." His voice was heavy, coarse. Miss Wunderly looked up at Spade, quickly, puckering her forehead between her eyebrows.
"Oh, but you must be careful."
Her voice shook a little, and her lips shaped the words with nervous jerkiness.
"I'm deathly afraid of him, of what he might do. She's so young, and his bringing her here from New York is such a serious... Might he do something to her?"
Spade smiled and patted the arms of his chair. "Just leave that to us," he said. "We'll know how to handle him."
"But mightn't he?"
she insisted.
There's always a chance," Spade nodded judicially. "But you can trust us to take care of that."
"Oh, I do trust you," she said earnestly. "But I want you to know that he's a dangerous man. I honestly don't think he'd stop at anything. I don't believe he'd hesitate to kill Corinne if he thought it would save him. Mightn't he do that?"
"You didn't threaten him, did you?"
"I told him that all I wanted was to get her home before Mama and Papa came, so they'd never know what she had done. I promised him I'd never say a word to them about it if he helped me. But if he didn't, Papa would certainly see that he was punished. I don't suppose he believed me altogether."
"Can he cover up by marrying her?" Archer asked.
The girl blushed and replied in a confused voice,
"He has a wife and three children in England. Corinne wrote me that, to explain why she had gone off with him."
They usually do," Spade said, "though not always in England."
He leaned forward to reach for pencil and pad of paper. "What does he look like?"
"Oh, he's 35 years old, perhaps, and as tall as you, and either naturally dark or quite sunburned. His hair is dark, too, and he has thick eyebrows. He talks in a rather loud, blustery way and has a nervous, irritable manner. He gives the impression of being a violence."
Spade, scribbling on the pad, asked without looking up,
"What color eyes?"
"They're blue-gray and watery, though not in a weak way. And, oh yes, he has a marked cleft in his chin."
"Thin, medium, or a heavy build?"
"Quite athletic. He's broad-shouldered and carries himself erect. Has what could be called a decidedly military carriage. He was wearing a light gray suit and a gray hat when I saw him this morning."
"What does he do for a living?" Spade asked as he laid down his pencil.
"I don't know," she said. "I haven't the slightest idea."
"What time is he coming to see you?"
"After 8 o'clock.
"All right, Miss Wunderly, we'll have a man there. He'll help if..."
"Mr. Spade, could either you or Mr. Archer..."
She made an appealing gesture with both hands.
"Could either of you look after it personally? I don't mean that the man you'd send wouldn't be capable, but... Oh, I'm so afraid of what might happen to Corinne. I'm afraid of him. Could you... I'd expect to be charged more, of course."
She opened her handbag with nervous fingers and put $200 bills on Spade's desk.
"Would that be enough?"
"Yeah," Archer said. "And I'll look after it myself."
Miss Wunderly stood up, impulsively holding a hand out to him.
"Oh, thank you, thank you,"
she exclaimed, and then gave Spade her hand, repeating,
"Thank you."
"Not at all," Spade said over it. "Glad to. It'll help some if you either meet Thursby downstairs or let yourself be seen in the lobby with him at some time."
"I will,"
she promised, and thanked the partners again.
"And don't look for me,"
Archer cautioned her.
"I'll see you all right."
Spade went to the corridor door with Miss Wunderly. When he returned to his desk, Archer nodded at the $100 bills there, growled complacently.
They're right enough.
Picked one up, folded it, and tucked it into a vest pocket.
And they had brothers in her bag.
Spade pocketed the other bill before he sat down. Then he said,
Well, don't dynamite her too much. What do you think of her? Sweet! And you telling me not to dynamite her?
Archer guffawed suddenly without merriment.
Maybe you saw her first, Sam, but I spoke first.
He put his hands in his trousers pockets and teetered on his heels.
You'll play hell with her, you will.
Spade grinned wolfishly, showing the edges of teeth far back in his jaw.
You've got brains, yes you have.
He began to make a cigarette. Death in the fog. A telephone bell rang in darkness. When it had rung three times, bed springs creaked, fingers fumbled on wood, something small and hard thudded on a carpet floor. The springs creaked again, and a man's voice said,
Hello? Yeah, speaking. Dead? Yes. 15 minutes. Thanks.
A switch clicked, and a white bowl hung on three gilded chains from the ceiling center filled the room with light. Spade, barefooted in green and white checked pajamas, sat on the side of his bed. He scowled at the telephone on the table while his hands took from beside it a packet of brown papers and a sack of Bull Durham tobacco. Cold, steamy air blew in through two open windows, bringing with it half a dozen times a minute the Alcatraz foghorn's dull moaning. A tinny alarm clock insecurely mounted on a corner of Duke's Celebrated Criminal Cases of America, face down on the table, held its hands at 5 minutes past two. Spade's thick fingers made a cigarette with deliberate care, sifting a measured quantity of tan flakes down into curved paper, spreading the flakes so that they lay equal at the ends with a slight depression in the middle, thumbs rolling the paper's inner edge down and up under the outer edges as forefingers pressed it over, thumbs and fingers sliding to the paper cylinder's ends to hold it even while tongue licked the flap, left forefinger and thumb pinching their end, while right forefinger and thumb smoothed the damp seam, right forefinger and thumb twisting their end and lifting the other to Spade's mouth. He picked up the pigskin and nickel lighter that had fallen to the floor, manipulated it, and with a cigarette burning in the corner of his mouth, stood up. He took off his pajamas. The smooth thickness of his arms, legs, and body, the sag of his big, rounded shoulders, made his body like a bear's. It was like a shaved bear's. His chest was hairless. His skin was childishly soft and pink. He scratched the back of his neck and began to dress. He put on a thin white union suit, gray socks, black garters, and dark brown shoes. When he had fastened his shoes, he picked up the telephone, called Greystone 4500, and ordered a taxicab. Put on a green-striped white shirt, soft white collar, a green necktie, the gray suit he had worn that day, a loose tweed overcoat, and a dark gray hat. The street doorbell rang as he stuffed tobacco, keys, and money into his pockets. Where Bush Street roofed Stockton before slipping downhill to Chinatown, Spade paid his fare and left the taxicab. San Francisco's night fog, thin, clammy, and penetrant, blurred the street. A few yards from where Spade had dismissed the taxicab, a small group of men stood looking up an alley. Two women stood with a man on the other side of Bush Street looking at the alley. There were faces at windows. Spade crossed the sidewalk between iron-railed hatchways that opened above bare, ugly stairs, went to the parapet, and resting his hands on the damp coping, looked down into Stockton Street. An automobile popped out of the tunnel beneath him with a roaring swish, as if it had been blown out, and ran away. Not far from the tunnel's mouth, a man was hunkered on his heels before a billboard that held advertisements of a moving picture and a gasoline across the front of a gap between two store buildings. The hunkered man's head was bent almost to the sidewalk so he could look under the billboard. A hand flat on the paving, a hand clenched on the billboard's green frame, held him in this grotesque position. Two other men stood awkwardly together at one end of the billboard, peeping through the few inches of space between it and the building at that end. The building at the other end had a blank gray sidewall that looked down on the lot behind the billboard. Lights flickered on the sidewall, and the shadows of men moving among lights. Spade turned from the parapet and walked up Bush Street to the alley where men were grouped. A uniformed policeman chewing gum under an enameled sign that said Burritt Station in white against dark blue put out an arm and asked,
"What do you want here?"
"I'm Sam Spade. Tom Polhouse phoned me."
"Ah, yeah, sure you are."
The policeman's arm went down.
"Yeah, I didn't know you at first. Well, they're back there."
He jerked a thumb over his shoulder.
"Bad business."
"Yeah, bad enough," Spade agreed, and went up the alley. Halfway up it, not far from the entrance, a dark ambulance stood. Behind the ambulance, to the left, the alley was bounded by a waist-high fence, horizontal strips of rough boarding. From the fence, dark ground fell away steeply to the billboard on Stockton Street below. A 10-foot length of the fence's top rail had been torn from a post at one end and hung dangling from the other. 15 feet down the slope, a flat boulder stuck out. In the notch between boulder and slope, Miles Archer lay on his back. Two men stood over him. One of them held the beam of an electric torch on the dead man. Other men with lights moved up and down the slope. One of them hailed Spade.
"Hello, Sam!"
and clambered up to the alley, his shadow running up the slope before him. He was a barrel-bellied tall man with shrewd eyes, a thick mouth, and carelessly shaven dark jowls. His shoes, knees, hands, and chin were daubed with brown loam.
"I figured you'd want to see it before we took him away,"
he said as he stepped over the broken fence. "Thanks, Tom," Spade said. "What happened?" He put an elbow on a fence post and looked down at the men below, nodding to those who nodded to him. Tom Polhouse poked his own left breast with a dirty finger.
"Got him right through the pump with this."
He took a fat revolver from his coat pocket and held it out to Spade. Mud inlaid the depressions in the revolver's surface.
"A Webley. English, ain't it?"
Spade took his elbow from the fence post and leaned down to look at the weapon, but he did not touch it.
"Yes," he said. "Webley Fosbury automatic revolver. That's it. 38, 8-shot. They don't make them anymore. How many gone out of it?"
"One pill."
Tom poked his breast again.
"Yeah, he must have been dead when he cracked the fence."
He raised the muddy revolver.
"Ever seen this before?"
Spade nodded.
"I've seen Webley Fosbury's," he said without interest, and then spoke rapidly. "You shot up here, huh? Standing where you are with his back to the fence? The man that shot him stands here."
He went around in front of Tom and raised a hand breast high with leveled forefinger.
"Let's him have it, and Miles goes back, taking the top of the fence and going on through and down till the rock catches him. That it?"
"That's it,"
Tom replied slowly, working his brows together.
"The blast burned his coat."
"Who found him?"
"The man on the beach, chilling. He was coming down Bush, and just as he got here, a machine turning threw headlights up here, and he saw the top of the fence, so he came up to look at it and found him."
"What about the machine that was turning around?"
"Not a damn thing about it, Sam. Schilling didn't pay any attention to it, not knowing anything was wrong then. He says nobody didn't come out of here while he was coming down from Powell, or he'd have seen him. The only other way out would be under the billboard on Stockton. Nobody went that way. The fog's got the ground soggy, and the only marks are where Miles slid down and where this here gun rolled."
"Didn't anybody hear the shot?"
"For the love of God, Sam, we only just got here. Somebody must have heard it when we find them."
He turned and put a leg over the fence.
"Coming down for a look at him before he's moved?"
Spade said, "No." Tom halted astride the fence and looked back at Spade with surprised small eyes.
Spade said, "You've seen him. You'd see everything I could."
Tom, still looking at Spade, nodded doubtfully and withdrew his leg over the fence.
"His gun was tucked away on his hip,"
he said.
"It hadn't been fired. His overcoat was buttoned. There's $161 in his clothes. Was he working, Sam?"
Spade, after a moment's hesitation, nodded. Tom asked,
Well?
He was supposed to be trailing a fellow named Floyd Thursby, Spade said, and described Thursby as Miss Wenderley had described him.
What for?
Spade put his hands into his overcoat pockets and blinked sleepy eyes at Tom. Tom repeated impatiently.
What for?
He was an Englishman, maybe. I don't know what his game was exactly. We were trying to find out where he lived.
Spade grinned faintly and took a hand from his pocket to pat Tom's shoulder.
Don't crowd me.
Put the hand in his pocket again.
I'm going to go out to break the news to Miles' wife.
He turned away. Tom, scowling, opened his mouth, closed it without having said anything, cleared his throat, put the scowl off his face, and spoke with a husky sort of gentleness.
Yeah, it's tough, him getting it like that. Miles had his fall, same as the rest of us, but I guess he must have had some good points, too.
Yeah, I guess so,
Spade agreed in a tone that was utterly meaningless, and went out of the alley. In an all-night drugstore on the corner of Bush and Taylor Streets, Spade used a telephone.
Precious, he said into it a little while after he'd been given a number. Miles has been shot.
Yeah, he's dead.
Now, don't get excited.
Yeah. You'll have to break it to Iva.
No, I'm damned if I will. You've got to do it.
That's a good girl. And keep her away from the office. Tell her I'll see her. Sometime.
Yeah, but don't tie me up to anything.
That's the stuff. You're an angel. Bye.
Spade's tinny alarm clock said 3:40 when he turned on the light in the suspended bowl again. He dropped his hat and overcoat on the bed and went into his kitchen, returning to the bedroom with a wine glass and a tall bottle of Bacardi. He poured a drink and drank it standing. He put bottle and glass on the table, sat on the side of the bed facing them, and rolled a cigarette. He had drunk his third glass of Bacardi and was lighting his fifth cigarette when the street doorbell rang. The hands of the alarm clock registered 4:30. Spade sighed, rose from the bed, and went to the telephone box beside his bathroom door. He pressed the button that released the street door lock. He muttered,
"Damn her,"
and stood scowling at the black telephone box, breathing irregularly while a dull flush grew in his cheeks. The grating and rattling of the elevator door opening and closing came from the corridor. Spade sighed again and moved towards the corridor door. Soft, heavy footsteps sounded on the carpeted floor outside. The footsteps of two men. Spade's face brightened. His eyes were no longer harassed. He opened the door quickly.
"Ah, hello, Tom,"
he said to the barrel-bellied tall detective with whom he had talked in Burritt Street. And...
"Hello, Lieutenant,"
to the man beside Tom. "Come in." They nodded together, neither saying anything, and came in. Spade shut the door and ushered them into his bedroom. Tom sat on an end of the sofa by the windows. The lieutenant sat on a chair beside the table. The lieutenant was a compactly built man with a round head under short-cut grizzled hair and a square face behind a short-cut grizzled mustache. A $5 gold piece was pinned to his necktie, and there was a small, elaborate diamond-set secret society emblem on his lapel. Spade brought two wine glasses in from the kitchen, filled them and his own with Bacardi, gave one to each of his visitors, and sat down with his on the side of the bed. His face was placid and uncurious. He raised his glass and said,
"Success to crime,"
and drank it down. Tom emptied his glass, set it on the floor beside his feet, and wiped his mouth with a muddy forefinger. He stared at the foot of the bed, as if trying to remember something of which it vaguely reminded him. The lieutenant looked at his glass for a dozen seconds, took a very small sip of its contents, and put the glass on the table at his elbow. He examined the room with hard, deliberate eyes, and then looked at Tom. Tom moved uncomfortably on the sofa and, not looking up, asked,
"Did you Break the news to Miles' wife, Sam?
Spade said. Uh-huh.
How'd she take it?
Spade shook his head.
I don't know anything about women.
Tom said softly.
How the hell you don't?
The lieutenant put his hands on his knees and leaned forward. His greenish eyes were fixed on Spade in a peculiarly rigid stare, as if their focus were a matter of mechanics, to be changed only by pulling a lever or pressing a button.
What kind of gun do you carry?
He asked. None.
I don't like them much. Of course, there are some in the office. I'd like to see one of them,
the lieutenant said.
You don't happen to have one here?
No.
You sure of that?
Look around. Spade smiled and waved his empty glass a little.
Turn the dump upside down if you want. I won't squawk. If you've got a search warrant.
Tom protested.
Aw, hell, Sam.
Spade set his glass on the table and stood up, facing the lieutenant. What do you want, Dundee? He asked, in a voice hard and cold as his eyes. Lieutenant Dundee's eyes had moved to maintain their focus on Spade's. Only his eyes had moved. Tom shifted his weight on the sofa again, blew a deep breath out through his nose, and growled plaintively.
We're not wanting to make any trouble, Sam.
Spade, ignoring Tom, said to Dundee, Well, what do you want?
Talk turkey. Who in the hell do you think you are coming in here trying to rope me? All right,
Dundee said in his chest.
Sit down and listen. I'll sit or stand as I damn please, said Spade, not moving.
For Christ's sake, be reasonable,
Tom begged.
What's the use of us having a row, huh? If you want to know why we didn't talk turkey, it's because when I asked you who this Thursby was, you as good as told me it was none of my business. You can't treat us that way, Sam. It ain't right. It won't get you anywheres. We got our work to do.
Lieutenant Dundee jumped up, stood close to Spade, and thrust his square face up at the taller man's.
I've warned you your foot was going to slip one of these days, he said.
Spade made a depreciative mouth, raising his eyebrows.
Everybody's foot slips sometimes, he replied with a derisive mildness. And this is yours.
Spade smiled and shook his head.
No, I'll do nicely, thank you.
He stopped smiling. His upper lip on the left side twitched over his eye tooth. His eyes became narrow and sultry. His voice came out deep as the lieutenant's.
I don't like this. What are you sucking around for? Tell me or get out and let me go to bed. Who's Thursby?
Dundee demanded.
I told Tom what I knew about him. You told Tom damn little.
I knew damn little.
Why were you tailing him?
I wasn't. Miles was. For the swell reason that we had a client who was paying good United States money to have him tailed.
Who's the client?
Placidity came back to Spade's face and voice. He said reprovingly,
You know I can't tell you that until I've talked it over with the client. You'll tell it to me or you'll tell it in court,
Dundee said hotly.
This is murder, don't you forget it.
Maybe.
And here's something for you not to forget, sweetheart. I'll tell it or not as I damn please. It's a long while since I burst out crying because policemen didn't like me.
Tom left the sofa and sat on the foot of the bed. His carelessly shaven, mud-smeared face was tired and lined.
Be reasonable, Sam,
he pleaded.
Give us a chance. How can we turn up anything on Miles' killing if you won't give us what you've got?
You needn't get a headache over that, Spade told him. I'll bury my dead.
Lieutenant Dundee sat down and put his hands on his knees again. His eyes were warm green disks.
Yeah, I thought you would, he said.
He smiled with grim content.
That's just exactly why we came to see you. Isn't it, Tom?
Tom groaned but said nothing articulate. Spade watched Dundee warily.
That's just exactly what I said to Tom, the lieutenant went on. I said, Tom, I've got a hunch that Sam Spade's a man to keep the family troubles in the family. That's just what I said to him.
The wariness went out of Spade's eyes. He made his eyes dull with boredom. He turned his face around to Tom and asked with great carelessness,
What's itching your boyfriend now?
Dundee jumped up and tapped Spade's chest with the ends of two bent fingers.
Just this, he said,
taking pains to make each word distinct.
emphasizing them with his tapping finger ends.
Thursby was shot down in front of his hotel just 35 minutes after you left Burritt Street.
Spade spoke, taking equal pains with his words.
Keep your goddamn paws off me.
Dundee withdrew the tapping fingers, but there was no change in his voice.
Tom says you were in too much of a hurry to even stop for a look at your partner.
Tom growled apologetically.
Well, damn it, Sam, you did run off like that.
And you didn't go to Archer's house to tell his wife,
the lieutenant said.
We called up and that girl in your office was there and she said you sent her.
Spade nodded. His face was stupid in its calmness. Lieutenant Dundee raised his two bent fingers toward Spade's chest, quickly lowered them, and said,
I give you 10 minutes to get to a phone and do your talking to the girl. I give you 10 minutes to get to Thursby's joint, Geary, near Leavenworth. You could do it easy in that time, or 15 at the most. And that gives you 10 or 15 minutes of waiting before he showed up.
I knew where he lived, Spade asked. And I knew he hadn't gone straight home from killing Miles.
You knew what you knew,
Dundee replied stubbornly.
What time did you get home?
4:20. I walked around thinking things over.
The lieutenant wagged his round head up and down.
We knew you weren't home at 3:30. We tried to get you on the phone. Where'd you do your walking?
Out Bush Street away and back.
Did you see anybody that...
No, no witnesses, Spade said, and laughed pleasantly.
Sit down, Dundee. You haven't finished your drink. Get your glass, Tom.
Tom said,
No thanks, Sam.
Dundee sat down, but paid no attention to his glass of rum. Spade filled his own glass, drank, set the empty glass on the table, and returned to his bedside seat.
I know where I stand now, he said, looking with friendly eyes from one of the police detectives to the other.
Hey, I'm sorry I get up on my hind legs, but you birds coming in trying to put the works on me made me nervous. Having Miles knocked off bothered me, and then you birds cracking Foxy.
That's all right now, though, now that I know what you're up to.
Tom said,
Forget it.
The lieutenant said nothing. Spade asked, Thursby die? While the lieutenant hesitated, Tom said,
Yes.
Then the lieutenant said angrily,
And you might just as well know it if you don't that he died before you could tell anybody anything.
Spade was rolling a cigarette. He asked, not looking up,
What do you mean by that? You think I did know it?
I meant what I said,
Dundee replied bluntly. Spade looked up at him and smiled, holding the finished cigarette in one hand, his lighter in the other.
You're not ready to pinch me yet, are you, Dundee? He asked.
Dundee looked with hard green eyes at Spade and did not answer him.
Then, said Spade, there's no particular reason why I should give a damn what you think, is there, Dundee?
Tom said,
Be reasonable, Sam.
Spade put the cigarette in his mouth, set fire to it, and laughed smoke out.
I'll be reasonable, Tom, he promised. How did I kill this Thursby? I've forgotten.
Tom grunted disgust. Lieutenant Dundee said,
He was shot 4 times in the back with a .44 or .45 from across the street when he started to go in the hotel. Nobody saw, but that's the way it figures.
And he was wearing a Luger and a shoulder holster,
Tom added.
It hadn't been fired.
What do the hotel people know about him? Spade asked.
Nothing, except that he'd been there a week.
Alone?
Yeah, alone.
What'd you find on him? Or in his room?
Dundee drew his lips in and asked,
What'd you think we'd find?
Spade made a careless circle with his limp cigarette.
Something to tell you who he was, what his store was. Did you?
We thought you could tell us that.
Spade looked at the lieutenant with yellow-gray eyes that held an almost exaggerated amount of candor.
I've never seen Thursby, dead or alive.
Lieutenant Dundee stood up, looking dissatisfied. Tom rose, yawning and stretching.
We've asked what we came to ask,
Dundee said, frowning over eyes hard as green pebbles. He held his mustached upper lip tight to his teeth, letting his lower lip push the words out.
We've told you more than you've told us. That's fair enough. You know me, Spade,
If you did or you didn't, you'll get a square deal out of me. And most of the breaks. I don't know that I blame you a hell of a lot, but that wouldn't keep me from nailing you.
Fair enough, Spade replied evenly. But I'd feel better about it if you'd drink your drink. Lieutenant Dundee turned to the table, picked up his glass, and slowly emptied it. Then he said,
Good night,
and held out his hand. They shook hands ceremoniously. Tom and Spade shook hands ceremoniously. Spade let them out. Then he undressed, turned off the lights, and went to bed. Three Women. When Spade reached his office at 10 o'clock the following morning, Effie Perrin was at her desk opening the morning's mail. Her boyish face was pale under a sunburn. She put down the handful of envelopes and the brass paper knife she held and said, She's in there. Her voice was low and warning.
I asked you to keep her away, Spade complained.
He, too, kept his voice low. Effie Perrin's brown eyes opened wide, and her voice was as irritable as his.
Yes, but you didn't tell me how.
Her eyelids went together a little, and her shoulders drooped.
Don't be cranky, Sam, she said wearily. I had her all night.
Spade stood beside the girl, put a hand on her head, and smoothed her hair away from its parting.
Ah, sorry, Angel, I haven't.
He broke off as the inner door opened.
Hello, Iva,
he said to the woman who had opened it.
Oh, Sam,
she said. She was a blonde woman of a few more years than 30. Her facial prettiness was perhaps 5 years past its best moment. Her body, for all its sturdiness, was finely modeled and exquisite. She wore black clothes from hat to shoes. They had, as morning, an impromptu air. Having spoken, she stepped back from the door and stood waiting for Spade. He took his hand from Effie Perrin's head and entered the inner office, shutting the door. Iva came quickly to him, raising her sad face for his kiss. Her arms were around him before his held her. When they had kissed, he made a little movement as if to release her, but she pressed her face to his chest and began sobbing. He stroked her round back, saying,
Poor darling.
His voice was tender. His eyes, squinting at the desk that had been his partner's, across the room from his own, were angry. He drew his lips back over his teeth in an impatient grimace and turned his chin aside to avoid contact with the crown of her hat.
Did you send for Miles's brother?
He asked.
Yes, he came over this morning.
The words were blurred by her sobbing and his coat against her mouth. He grimaced again and bent his head for a surreptitious look at the watch on his wrist. His left arm was around her, the hand on her left shoulder. His cuff was pulled back far enough to leave the watch uncovered. It showed 10:10. The woman stirred in his arms and raised her face again. Her blue eyes were wet, round, and white-ringed. Her mouth was moist.
Oh, Sam,
she moaned.
Did you kill him?
Spade stared at her with bulging eyes. His bony jaw fell down. He took his arms from her and stepped back out of her arms. He scowled at her and cleared his throat. She held her arms up as he had left them. Anguish clouded her eyes, partly closed them under eyebrows pulled up at the inner ends. Her soft, damp red lips trembled. Spade laughed, a harsh syllable,
ha,
and went to the buff curtain window. He stood there with his back to her, looking through the curtain into the court until she started towards him. Then he turned quickly and went to his desk. He sat down, put his elbows on the desk, his chin between his fists, and looked at her. His yellowish eyes glittered between narrowed lids.
Who, he asked coldly, put that bright idea in your head?
I thought...
She lifted a hand to her mouth and fresh tears came to her eyes. She came to stand beside the desk, moving with easy, sure-footed grace in black slippers, whose smallness and heel height were extreme.
"Be kind to me, Sam,"
she said humbly. He laughed at her, his eyes still glittering.
"You killed my husband, Sam. Be kind to me."
He clapped his palms together and said,
"Jesus Christ."
She began to cry audibly, holding a white handkerchief to her face. He got up and stood close behind her. He put his arms around her. He kissed her neck between ear and coat collar. He said, "Now, Iva, don't." His face was expressionless. When she had stopped crying, he put his mouth to her ear and murmured,
"You shouldn't have come here today, precious. It wasn't wise. You can't stay. You ought to be home."
She turned around in his arms to face him and asked,
"You'll come tonight?"
He shook his head gently.
Not tonight.
Soon?
Yes.
How soon?
As soon as I can.
He kissed her mouth, led her to the door, opened it, said,
"Goodbye, Iva."
Bowed her out, shut the door, and returned to his desk. He took tobacco and cigarette papers from his vest pockets, but did not roll a cigarette. He sat holding the papers in one hand, the tobacco in the other, and looked with brooding eyes at his dead partner's desk. Effie Perrin opened the door and came in. Her brown eyes were uneasy. Her voice was careless. She asked,
"Well?"
Spade said nothing. His brooding gaze did not move from his partner's desk. The girl frowned and came around to his side.
"Well?"
she asked in a louder voice.
"How did you and the widow make out?"
"She thinks I shot Miles," he said. Only his lips moved.
"So you can marry her?"
Spade made no reply to that. The girl took his hat from his head and put it on the desk. Then she leaned over and took the tobacco sack and the papers from his inert fingers.
"The police think I shot Thursby," he said.
"Who is he?"
she asked, separating a cigarette paper from the packet, sifting tobacco into it.
"Who do you think I shot?"
he asked. When she ignored that question, he said,
"Thursby's the guy Miles was supposed to be tailing for the Wonderly girl."
Her thin fingers finished shaping the cigarette. She licked it, smoothed it, twisted its ends, and placed it between Spade's lips. He said,
"Thanks, honey,"
put an arm around her slim waist, and rested his cheek wearily against her hip, shutting his eyes.
"Are you going to marry Iva?"
she asked, looking down at his pale brown hair.
"Don't be silly,"
he muttered. The unlighted cigarette bobbed up and down with the movement of his lips.
"She doesn't think it's silly. Why should she, the way you've played around with her?"
He sighed and said,
"I wish to God I'd never seen her."
"Maybe you do now."
A trace of spitefulness came into the girl's voice.
"But there was a time."
"I never know what to do or say to women except that way," he grumbled. "And then I didn't like Miles."
"Oh, that's a lie, Sam," the girl said. "You know I think she's a louse, but I'd be a louse too if it would give me a body like hers."
Spade rubbed his face impatiently against her hip, but said nothing. Effie Perrin bit her lip, wrinkled her forehead, and bending over for a better view of his face, asked,
"Do you suppose she could have killed him?"
Spade sat up straight and took his arm from her waist. He smiled at her. His smile held nothing but amusement. He took out his lighter, snapped on the flame, and applied it to the end of his cigarette.
"You're an angel," he said tenderly through smoke. "A nice, rattle-brained angel."
She smiled a bit wryly.
"Oh, am I? Suppose I told you that your Iva hadn't been home many minutes when I arrived to break the news at 3 o'clock this morning."
"What are you telling me?"
he asked. His eyes had become alert, though his mouth continued to smile.
"She kept me waiting at the door while she undressed, or finished undressing. I saw her clothes where she had dumped them on a chair. Her hat and coat were underneath. Her singlet on top was still warm. She said she had been asleep, but she hadn't. She had wrinkled up the bed, but the wrinkles weren't mashed down. Spade took the girl's hand and patted it.
You're a detective, darling, but... He shook his head. She didn't kill him.
Effie Perrin snatched her hand away. That louse wants to marry you, Sam, she said bitterly. He made an impatient gesture with his head and one hand. She frowned at him and demanded, Did you see her last night?
No.
Honestly?
Honestly. Don't act like Dundee, sweetheart. It ill becomes you.
Has Dundee been after you?
Uh-huh. He and Tom Polehouse dropped in for a drink at 4 o'clock.
Do they really think you shot this... What's his name?
Thursby.
He dropped what was left of his cigarette into the brass tray and began to roll another. Do they? She insisted.
God knows. His eyes were on the cigarette he was making. They did have some such notion. I don't know how far. I talked them out of it.
Look at me, Sam. He looked at her and laughed, so that for the moment, merriment mingled with the anxiety in her face. You worry me, she said, seriousness returning to her face as she talked. You always think you know what you're doing, but you're too slick for your own good, and someday you're going to find it out. He sighed mockingly and rubbed his cheek against her arm.
That's what Dundee says. You keep Ivor away from me, sweet, and I'll manage to survive the rest of my troubles.
He stood up and put on his hat.
Have the Spade and Archer taken off the door and Samuel Spade put on. I'll be back in an hour, or phone you.
Spade went through the St. Mark's long, purplish lobby to the desk and asked a red-haired dandy whether Miss Wunderley was in. The red-haired dandy turned away and then back, shaking his head. She checked out this morning, Mr. Spade.
Thanks.
Spade walked past the desk to an alcove off the lobby where a plump, young, middle-aged man in dark clothes sat at a flat-top mahogany desk. On the edge of the desk, facing the lobby, was a triangular prism of mahogany and brass inscribed, Mr. Freed. The plump man got up and came around the desk holding out his hand. I was awfully sorry to hear about Archer, Spade, he said in the tone of one trained to sympathize readily, without intrusiveness. I've just seen it in the call. He was in here last night, you know.
Thanks, Freed. Were you talking to him?
No. He was sitting in the lobby when I came in early this evening. I didn't stop. I thought he was probably working, and I know you fellas like to be left alone when you're busy. Did that have anything to do with his...
I don't think so. But we don't know yet. Anyway, we won't mix the house up in it if it can be helped.
Thanks.
That's all right. Can you give me some dope on an ex-guest, and then forget that I asked for it?
Surely.
Miss Wunderley checked out this morning. I'd like to know the details.
Come along,
Freed said.
And we'll see what we can learn.
Spade stood still, shaking his head. I don't want a show in it.
Freed nodded and went out of the alcove. In the lobby, he halted suddenly and came back to Spade. Harriman was the house detective on duty last night, he said. He's sure to have seen Archer. Shall I caution him not to mention it?
Spade looked at Freed from the corners of his eyes. Better not. That won't make any difference as long as there's no connection shown with this Wunderley. Harriman's all right, but he likes to talk, and I'd as lief not to have him think there's anything to be kept quiet.
Freed nodded again and went away. 15 minutes later, he returned. She arrived last Tuesday, registering from New York. She hadn't a trunk, only some bags. There were no phone calls charged to her room, and she doesn't seem to have received much, if any, mail. The only one anybody remembers having seen her with was a tall, dark man of 36 or so. She went out at 9:30 this morning, came back an hour later, paid her bill, and had her bags carried out to a car. The boy who carried them says it was a Nash touring car, probably a hired one. She left a forwarding address, the Ambassador, Los Angeles.
Spade said, Thanks a lot, Freed, and left the St. Mark.
When Spade returned to his office, Effie Perrin stopped typing a letter to tell him, Your friend Dundee was in. He wanted to look at your guns.
And?
I told him to come back when you were here.
Good girl. If he comes back again, let him look at him.
And Miss Wunderley called up.
It's about time. What does she say?
She wants to see you. The girl picked up a slip of paper from her desk and read the memorandum penciled on it. She's at the Coronet on California Street, apartment 1001. You're to ask for Miss LeBlanc.
Spade said, Gimme. And held out his hand.
When she had given him the memorandum,
He took out his lighter, snapped on the flame, set it to the slip of paper, held the paper until but one corner was curling black ash, dropped it on the linoleum floor, and mashed it under his shoe sole. The girl watched him with disapproving eyes. He grinned at her, said, "That's just the way it is, dear," and went out again. The Black Bird. Miss Wonderly, in a belted green crepe silk dress, opened the door of apartment 1001 at the Coronet. Her face was flushed. Her dark red hair, parted on the left side, swept back in loose waves over her right temple, was somewhat tousled. Spade took off his hat and said, "Good morning." His smile brought a fainter smile to her face. Her eyes, of blue that was almost violet, did not lose their troubled look. She lowered her head and said in a hushed, timid voice,
"Come in, Mr. Spade."
She led him past open kitchen, bathroom, and bedroom doors into a cream and red living room, apologizing for its confusion.
"Everything is upside down. I haven't even finished unpacking."
She laid his hat on a table and sat down on a walnut settee. He sat on a brocaded oval-backed chair facing her. She looked at her fingers, working them together, and said,
"Mr. Spade, I have a terrible, terrible confession to make."
Spade smiled a polite smile, which she did not lift her eyes to see, and said nothing.
That story I told you yesterday was all a story,"
she stammered, and looked up at him now with miserable, frightened eyes.
"Oh, that," Spade said lightly. "We didn't exactly believe your story."
"Well, then..."
Perplexity was added to the misery and fright in her eyes.
"We believed your $200.
You mean..."
She seemed not to know what he meant.
"I mean that you paid us more than if you'd been telling the truth," he explained blandly. "And enough more to make it all right."
Her eyes suddenly lighted up. She lifted herself a few inches from the settee, settled down again, smoothed her skirt, leaned forward and spoke eagerly.
"And even now you'd be willing to..."
Spade stopped her with a palm-up motion of one hand. The upper part of his face frowned. The lower part smiled.
"That depends," he said. "The hell of it is, Miss... Is your name Wonderly or LeBlanc?"
She blushed and murmured,
"It's really O'Shaughnessy. Bridget O'Shaughnessy."
"The hell of it is, Miss O'Shaughnessy, that a couple of murders..."
She winced.
"Coming together like this, get everybody stirred up, make the police think they can go the limit, make everybody hard to handle and expensive. It's not..."
He stopped talking because she had stopped listening and was waiting for him to finish.
"Mr. Spade, tell me the truth."
Her voice quivered on the verge of hysteria. Her face had become haggard around desperate eyes.
"Am I to blame for last night?"
Spade shook his head.
"Not unless there are things I don't know about," he said. "You warned us that Thursby was dangerous. Of course, you lied to us about your sister and all, but that doesn't count. We didn't believe you."
He shrugged his sloping shoulders.
"I wouldn't say it was your fault."
She said,
"Thank you,"
very softly, and then moved her head from side to side.
"But I'll always blame myself."
She put a hand to her throat.
"Mr. Archer was so alive yesterday afternoon. So solid and hearty and..."
"Stop it," Spade commanded. "He knew what he was doing. They're the chances we take."
Was he married?"
"Yes, with 10,000 insurance, no children, and a wife who didn't like him."
"Oh, please don't,"
she whispered.
Spade shrugged again. "That's the way it was."
He glanced at his watch and moved from his chair to the settee beside her.
"There's no time for worrying about that now."
His voice was pleasant but firm.
"Out there, a flock of policemen and assistant district attorneys and reporters are running around with their noses to the ground. What do you want to do?"
"I want you to save me from it all,"
she replied in a thin, tremulous voice. She put a timid hand on his sleeve.
"Mr. Spade, Do they know about me?
Not yet. I wanted to see you first.
What would they think if they knew about the way I came to you, with those lies?
It would make them suspicious. That's why I've been stalling them till I could see you. I thought maybe we wouldn't have to let them know all of it. We ought to be able to fake a story that will rock them to sleep if necessary.
You don't think I had anything to do with the murders, do you?
Spade grinned at her and said, I forgot to ask you that. Did you?
No.
Well, that's good. Now, what are we going to tell the police? She squirmed on her end of the settee, and her eyes wavered between heavy lashes, as if trying and failing to free their gaze from his. She seemed smaller and very young and oppressed.
Must they know about me at all?
She asked.
I think I'd rather die than that, Mr. Spade. I can't explain now, but can't you somehow manage so that you can shield me from them, so I won't have to answer their questions? I don't think I could stand being questioned now. I think I would rather die. Can't you, Mr. Spade?
Yeah, maybe, he said. But I'll have to know what it's all about. She went down on her knees at his knees. She held her face up to him. Her face was wan, taut, and fearful over tight clasped hands.
I haven't lived a good life, she cried. I've been bad, worse than you could know. But I'm not all bad. Look at me, Mr. Spade. You know I'm not all bad, don't you? You can see that, can't you? Then can't you trust me a little? Oh, I'm so alone and afraid, and I've got nobody to help me if you won't help me. I know I've no right to ask you to trust me if I won't trust you. I do trust you, but I can't tell you. I can't tell you now. Later, I will, when I can. I'm afraid, Mr. Spade. I'm afraid of trusting you. I don't mean that. I do trust you, but I trusted Floyd, and I've nobody else. Nobody else, Mr. Spade. You can help me. You've said you can help me. If I hadn't believed you could save me, I would have run away today instead of sending for you. If I thought anybody else could save me, would I be down on my knees like this? I know this isn't fair of me, but be generous, Mr. Spade. Don't ask me to be fair. You're strong. You're resourceful. You're brave. You can spare me some of that strength and resourcefulness and courage, surely. Help me, Mr. Spade. Help me, because I need help so badly, and because if you don't, where will I find anyone who can, no matter how willing? Help me. I've no right to ask you to help me blindly, but I do ask you. Be generous, Mr. Spade. You can help me. Help me.
Spade, who had held his breath through much of this speech, now emptied his lungs with a long, sighing exhalation between pursed lips, and said,
You won't need much of anybody's help. You're good. You're very good. It's chiefly your eyes, I think, and that throb you get into your voice when you say things like, Be generous, Mr. Spade.
She jumped up on her feet, her face crimson painfully, but she held her head erect and she looked Spade straight in the eyes.
I deserve that, she said. I deserve it, but oh, I did want your help so much. I do want it and need it so much. And the lie was in the way I said it, not at all in what I said.
She turned away, no longer holding herself erect.
It is my own fault that you can't believe me now.
Spade's face reddened, and he looked down at the floor, muttering,
Now you're dangerous.
Bridget O'Shaughnessy went to the table and picked up his hat. She came back and stood in front of him, holding the hat, not offering it to him, but holding it for him to take if he wished. Her face was white and thin. Spade looked at his hat and asked, What happened last night?
Floyd came to the hotel at 9 o'clock. And we went out for a walk. I suggested that so Mr. Archer could see him. We stopped at a restaurant in Geary Street, I think it was, for supper and to dance, and came back to the hotel at about 12:30. Floyd left me at the door, and I stood inside and watched Mr. Archer follow him down the street on the other side.
Down? You mean towards Market Street?
Yes.
Do you know what they'd be doing in the neighborhood of Bush and Stockton where Archer was shot?
Isn't that near where Floyd lived?
No. It would be nearly a dozen blocks out of his way if he was going from your hotel to his. Well, what did you do after they had gone?
I went to bed. And this morning when I went out for breakfast, I saw the headlines in the papers and read about... you know. Then I went up to Union Square where I'd seen automobiles for hire and got one and went to the hotel for my luggage. After I found my room had been searched yesterday, I knew I would have to move, and I had found this place yesterday afternoon. So I came up here and then telephoned your office.
Your room at the St. Mark was searched? He asked.
Yes, while I was at your office.
She bit her lip.
I didn't mean to tell you that.
That means I'm not supposed to question you about it. She nodded shyly. He frowned. She moved his hat a little in her hands. He laughed impatiently and said, "Stop waving the hat in my face. Haven't I offered to do what I can?" She smiled contritely, returned the hat to the table, and sat beside him on the settee again. He said, "I've got nothing against trusting you blindly, except that I won't be able to do you much good if I haven't some idea of what it's all about. For instance, I've got to have some sort of a line on your Floyd Thursby."
"I met him in the Orient."
She spoke slowly, looking down at a pointed finger tracing eights on the settee between them.
"We came here from Hong Kong last week. He had promised to help me. He took advantage of my helplessness and dependence on him to betray me."
"Betray you how?" She shook her head and said nothing. Spade, frowning with impatience, asked, "Why did you want him shadowed?"
"I wanted to learn how far he had gone. He wouldn't even let me know where he was staying. I wanted to find out what he was doing, whom he was meeting, things like that."
"Did he kill Archer?" She looked up at him, surprised.
"Yes, certainly,"
she said. "He had a Luger and a shoulder holster. Archer wasn't shot with a Luger."
"He had a revolver in his overcoat pocket,"
she said. "You saw it?"
"Oh, I've seen it often. I know he always carries one there. I didn't see it last night, but I know he never wears an overcoat without it."
"Why all the guns?"
"He lived by them. There was a story in Hong Kong that he had come out there to the Orient as a bodyguard to a gambler who had had to leave the States, and that the gambler had since disappeared. They said Floyd knew about his disappearance. I don't know. I do know that he always went heavily armed and that he never went to sleep without covering the floor around his bed with crumpled newspaper so nobody could come silently into his room."
"Hmm. You picked a nice sort of playmate."
"Only that sort could have helped me,"
she said simply.
"If he had been loyal."
"Yes. If." Spade pinched his lower lip between finger and thumb and looked gloomily at her. The vertical creases over his nose deepened, drawing his brows together. "How bad a hole are you actually in?"
"As bad,"
she said,
"as could be."
"Physical danger?"
"I'm not heroic. I don't think there's anything worse than death."
"Then it's that."
"It's that as surely as we're sitting here."
She shivered.
"Unless you help me."
He took his fingers away from his mouth and ran them through his hair. "I'm not God," he said irritably. "I can't work miracles out of thin air." He looked at his watch. "The day's going and you're giving me nothing to work with. Who killed Thursby?" She put a crumpled handkerchief to her mouth and said,
"I don't know."
Through it. "Your enemies or his?"
"I don't know. His, I hope, but I'm afraid. I don't know."
"How was he supposed to be helping you? Why did you bring him here from Hong Kong?" She looked at him with frightened eyes and shook her head in silence. Her face was haggard and pitifully stubborn. Spade stood up, thrust his hands into the pockets of his jacket, and scowled down at her. "This is hopeless," he said savagely. "I can't do anything for you. I don't know what you want done. I don't even know if you know what you want." She hung her head and wept. He made a growling animal noise in his throat and went to the table for his hat.
"You won't..."
she begged in a small, choked voice, not looking up.
"Go to the police?"
"Ah, go to them!" he exclaimed, his voice loud with rage. "They've been running me ragged since 4 o'clock this morning. I made myself God knows how much trouble standing them off. For what? For some crazy notion that I can help you? I can't. I won't try." He pulled his hat on his head and pulled it down tight. "Go to them. All I've got to do is stand still and they'll be swarming all over me.
I'll tell him what I know and you'll have to take your chances.
She rose from the settee and held herself straight in front of him, though her knees were trembling. And she held her white, panic-stricken face up high, though she couldn't hold the twitching muscles of mouth and chin still. She said,
"You've been patient. You've tried to help me. It is hopeless and useless, I suppose."
She stretched out her right hand.
"I thank you for what you have done. I'll have to take my chances."
End of Disc 1.